Do I always have to call him that now? Is he not to be baby anymore?
You do.
Spring, 1473. The young Edward, Prince of Wales, and his uncle, Earl Rivers, my grey son Richard, now Sir Richard by order of his stepfather the King, and I make a grand progress to Wales so the little prince can see his country and be seen by as many people as possible. His father says that this is how we make our rule secure. We show ourselves to the people, and by demonstrating our wealth, our fertility, and our elegance, we make them feel secure in their monarchy. We go by slow stages. Edward is strong, but he is not yet 3 years old, and riding all day is too tiring for him. I order that he shall have a rest every afternoon, and go to bed in my chamber early at night. I am glad of the leisurely pace on my own account, riding pillion so that I can sit sideways, as the new curve of my belly is starting to show. We reach the pretty town of Ludlow without incident, and I decide to stay in Wales with my first-born son for the first half-year, until I am certain that the household is organized for his comfort and safety, and that he is settled and happy in his new home. He is all delight. There is no regret for him. He misses the company of his sisters, but he loves being the little prince at his own court, and he enjoys the company of his half-brother Richard and his uncle. He starts to learn the land around the castle, the deep valleys and beautiful mountains. He has the servants who have been with him since babyhood. He has new friends in the children of his court who are brought to learn and play with him, and he has the watchful care of my brother. It is I who cannot sleep for the week before I am due to leave him. Anthony is at ease, Richard is happy, and baby is joyous in his new home. Of course it is almost unbearable for me to leave him, for we have not been an ordinary royal family. We have not had a life of formality and distance. This boy was born in sanctuary, under threat of death. He slept in my bed for the first few months of his life, unheard of for a royal prince. He had no wet nurse. I suckled him myself, and it was my fingers that his little hands gripped as he first learned to walk. Neither he nor any of the others were sent away to be raised by nurses, or in a royal nursery at another palace. Edward has kept his children close, and this, his older son, is the first to leave us to take up his royal duties. I love him with a passion. He is my golden boy, the boy who came at last to secure my position as queen, and to give his father, then nothing more than a York pretender, a stronger claim to the throne. He is my prince. He is the crown of our marriage. He is our future. Edward comes to join me for my last month at Ludlow in June, bringing the news that Anthony's wife, Lady Elizabeth, has died. She had been in ill health for years with a wasting sickness. Anthony orders masses said for her soul, and I, secretly and ashamed of myself, start to wonder who might be the next wife for my brother. "Time enough for that," Edward says. But Anthony will have to play his part for the safety of the kingdom. He might have to marry a French princess. I need allies. But not go from home, I say, and not leave Edward. No, I see he has made Ludlow his own, and Edward will need him here when we leave. And we must leave soon. I have given orders that we will go within the month. I gasp, though in truth I have known that this day must come. We will come again to see him, he promises me, and he will come to us. No need to look so tragic, my love. He is starting his work as a prince of the House of York. This is his future. You must be glad for him. I am glad, I say, without any conviction at all. When it is time for me to go, I have to pinch my cheeks to bring color into them and bite my mouth to stop myself crying. Anthony knows what it costs me to leave the three of them, but baby is happy, confident that he will come to court in London soon on a visit, enjoying his new freedom and the importance of being the prince in his own country. He lets me kiss him and hold him without wriggling. He even whispers in my ear, "I love you, Mama." Then he kneels for my blessing, but he comes up smiling. Anthony lifts me into the pillion saddle behind my master of horse, and I hold on tightly to his belt. I am awkward now, in the 7th month of my pregnancy. A sudden wave of the darkest anxiety comes over me, and I look from my brother to my 2 sons, real fear clutching at me. Take care, I say to baby. Look after him, I say to Anthony. Write to me. Don't let him take jumps on his pony. I know that he wants to, but he's too small. And don't let him get chilled. Don't let him read in poor light, and keep him away from anyone with illness. If there is plague in the town, then take him right away. I cannot think what I should warn them against. I am just flooded with anxiety as I look from one smiling face to another. Really, I say weakly. Really, Anthony. Guard him. He steps up to the horse and takes hold of the toe of my boot and shakes it gently. Your Grace, he says simply. Really. I am here to guard him. I will guard him. I will keep him safe. And you, I whisper. You keep safe too. Anthony, I feel so afraid. But I don't know what to fear. I don't know what to say. I want to warn you. But I don't know what danger there is. I look over to where my son Richard Grey is leaning against the castle gateway, a young man grown tall and handsome. And my Grey son, I say. My Richard. I cannot tell you why, but I am fearful for you all. He steps back and shrugs his shoulders. Sister mine, he says tenderly, there is always danger. Your sons and I will be men, and we will face it like men. Don't you go frightening yourself with imaginary threats, and have a safe journey and a safe confinement. We are all hoping for another prince as good as this one. Edward gives the order to move out and leads the way, his standard going before him, his household guard around him. The royal procession starts to unroll like a scarlet ribbon through the castle gates, the bright red of the livery studded with the rippling standards. The trumpets sound. The birds fly up from the castle roofs and whirl in the sky, announcing that the king and queen are leaving their precious son. I cannot stop the onward march, and I should not stop it. But I look back over my shoulder at my little son, at my grown son, and at my brother, until the fall of the road from the inner keep down to the outer wall has hidden them, and I see them no more. And when I can see them no more, I am filled with such darkness that for a moment I think night has fallen, and there will never be a dawn again. July, 1473. We halt at the town of Shrewsbury on the way back to London in the last days of July, for me to go into confinement in the guest rooms of the Great Abbey. I am glad to be out of the glare and the heat of summer, and into the coolness of the shuttered room. I have ordered them to set a fountain in the corner of my stone-walled chambers, and the drip, drip of the water soothes me as I lie on the daybed and wait for my time. This is a town built around the sacred well of St. Winifred, and as I listen to the dripping fountain of her water, and hear the ringing of the hours for prayer, I think of the spirits that move in waters of this wet land, both the pagan and the holy, Melusina and Winifred, and how the springs and streams and rivers speak to all men, but perhaps especially to women, who know in their own bodies the movement of the waters of the earth. Every holy site in England is a well or a spring. The baptismal fonts are filled with holy water that goes back, blessed, to the earth. It is a country for Melusina, and her element is everywhere, sometimes flowing in the rivers, sometimes hidden underground, but always present. In the middle of August, the pains start, and I turn my head to the fountain and listen to the trickle, as if I was seeking the voice of my mother in the water. The baby comes easily, as I thought he would. And he is a boy, as my mother knew he would be. Edward comes into the chamber, though men are supposed to be banned until I have been churched. I had to come and see you, he says. A son. Another son. God bless you and keep you both. God bless you, my love, and thank you for your pains to give me another boy. I thought you did not mind if it was a boy or a girl, I tease him. I love my girls, he says at once, but the House of York needed another boy. He can be a companion to his brother Edward. Can we call him Richard? I ask. I thought Henry. Henry for the next one, I say. Let's call this boy Richard. My mother herself named him to me. Edward bends over the cradle where the tiny boy is sleeping, and then he understands my words. Your mother? She knew you would have a boy. Yes, she knew, I say, smiling. Or at any rate, she pretended to know. You remember my mother. It was always one part magic and one part nonsense. And is this our last boy, did she say? Or do you think there will be another? Why not another? I say lazily. If you still want me in your bed, that is. If you have not had enough of me. If you are not tired of me. If you don't prefer your other women. He turns from the cradle and comes to me. His hands slide under my shoulder blades and lift me up to his mouth. Oh, I still want you, he says. Spring, 1476. I am proved right. It was by no means my last confinement. My husband continued as fertile as the bull in the water meadow that I accused him of being. In the second year after the birth of Richard, I was pregnant again, and in November I had another baby, a girl whom we called Anne. Edward rewards me for my labours by making my son Thomas Grey the Marquis of Dorset, and I marry him to a pleasant girl, an heiress to a mighty fortune. Edward had hoped for a boy, and we had promised to name him George as a compliment to the other York Duke, and so that there are once again three boys of York named Edward, Richard, and George. But the Duke shows no sign of gratitude. He was a spoiled, greedy boy, and he has grown into a disappointed, bad-tempered man. He is in his mid-twenties now, and his rosebud mouth has drooped into a sneer of disdain. He gloried at being one of the sons of York when he was a hopeful boy. Since then, he was first in line for the throne of England as Warwick's chosen heir, and then displaced when Warwick favoured Lancaster. When Edward won back the throne, George became first in line to inherit, but then was pushed down to second at the birth of my baby, Prince Edward. Since the birth of Prince Richard, George drops down to third in line to the throne of England. Indeed, every time I have a son, the Duke George drops down one more step away from the throne and deeper into jealousy. And since Edward is famously uxorious and I am famously fertile, George's inheritance of the throne has become a most unlikely event, and he is the Duke of Disappointment. Richard, the other York brother, does not seem to mind this, but he turns against us after the Yorks come back from France without fighting a war, but winning a peace. My husband, the king, and every man and woman of sense throughout the entire country, rejoice that Edward has made a peace with France that should last for years, in which they will pay us a fortune not to claim our lands in France. Everyone is delighted to escape a costly and painful foreign war, except Duke Richard, the boy who was raised on a battlefield and now cites the rights of Englishmen over our lands in France, clings to the memory of his father, who spent much of his life fighting the French, and all but calls his brother the king a lazy coward in not leading yet another expensive and dangerous expedition. Edward laughs his good-tempered laugh and lets the insult go, but Richard storms off to his lands in the north, taking his obedient wife Anne Neville with him, and sets himself up as a northern princeling, refusing to come south to us, believing himself to be the only true York of England, the only true heir to his father in his enmity with France. Nothing troubles Edward, and he is smiling when he comes to find me in the stables, where I'm looking over a new mayor, a gift from the King of France, to mark the new friendliness between our countries. She is a beautiful horse, but nervous at the new surroundings, and will not even come near me, though I have a tempting apple in my hand. Your brother came to me today to ask permission to go on pilgrimage and leave Edward in the care of his half-brother Sir Richard for a little while. I come out of the stable and close the door carefully behind me to keep the horse safely inside. Why? Where does he want to go? He wants to go to Rome, Edward says. He tells me he wants time away from the world. He gives me an odd, crooked smile. Seems that Ludlow has given him a taste for solitude. He wants to be a saint. He tells me he wants to find the poet in himself. He says he wants silence and the deserted road. He wants to find silence and wisdom. Oh, nonsense, I say, with a sister's scorn. He has always had this idea of going away. He has been planning to go to Jerusalem ever since he was a boy. He loves to travel, and he thinks that the Greeks and the Muslims know everything. He may want to go, but his life and his work are here. Just tell him no and make him stay. Edward hesitates. He has a great desire to do this, Elizabeth, and he is one of the greatest knights of Christendom. I don't think anyone can defeat him at the joust when he is on his day. And his poetry is as fine as that written by anyone. His reading and his knowledge is so wide, and his command of languages is greater than anyone else's in England. He is not an ordinary man. Perhaps it is his destiny to go far and learn more. He has served us well, none better, and if God has called him to travel, perhaps we should let him go. The mare comes and puts her head over the half-door to sniff at my shoulder. I stand still so as not to frighten her. Her warm, oaty breath blows on my neck. You're very tender of his talents, I say suspiciously. Why are you so admiring of him all of a sudden? He shrugs his shoulders, and at that small gesture, wife-like, I am on to him. I step forward and take both his hands in mine so he cannot escape my scrutiny. So who is she? What? What are you talking about? The new one. The new whore. The one who likes Anthony's poetry, I say bitingly. You never read it yourself. You never had such a high opinion of his learning and his destiny before. So someone has been reading to you. My guess is that she has been reading it to you. And if my guess is right, she knows it because he has been reading it to her, and probably Hastings knows her as well, and all of you think she is utterly lovely. But you will be bedding her, and the others sniffing round like dogs. You have a new and agreeable whore, and that I understand. But if you think you are going to share her stupid opinions with me, then she will have to go. He looks away from me. At his boots, at the sky, at the new mare. What's her name? I ask. You can tell me that at least. He pulls me towards him and folds me in his arms. Don't be angry, beloved, he whispers in my ear. You know there is only you, only ever you. Me and a score of others, I say irritably, but I don't pull away from him. They go through your bedroom like a May Day procession. No, he says, truly. There is only you. I have only one wife. I have a score of whores, perhaps hundreds, but only one wife. That is something, is it not? Your whores are young enough to be my daughters, I say crossly, and you go out into the city to chase them. And the city merchants complain to me that their wives and their daughters are not safe from you. No, my husband says with the vanity of a handsome man, they are not. I hope that no woman can resist me. But I never took anyone by force, Elizabeth. The only woman who ever resisted me was you. Do you remember drawing that dagger on me? I smile, despite myself. Of course I do. And you swearing that you would give me the scabbard, but it would be the last thing you ever gave me. There is no one like you. He kisses my brow, and then my closed eyelids, and then my lips. There is no one but you. No one but my wife holds my heart in her beautiful hands. So what is her name, I ask, as he kisses me into peace. What's the name of the new whore? Elizabeth Shaw, he says, his lips on my neck. But that doesn't matter. Anthony comes to my rooms as soon as he arrives at court, having made the journey from Wales, and I greet him at once with an absolute refusal to let him go away. No, truly, my dear, he says, you have to let me go. I am not going to Jerusalem, not this year, but I want to travel to Rome and confess my sins. I want to be away from the court for a while and think of things that matter and not things that are of the everyday. I want to ride from monastery to monastery and rise at dawn to pray, and where there is no religious house for me to spend the night, I want to sleep under the stars and seek God in the silence. Won't you miss me? I ask, childlike. Won't you miss baby and the girls? Yes, and that's why I don't even consider a crusade. I can't bear to be away for months. But Edward is settled in Ludlow with his playmates and his tutors, and young Richard Grey is a fine companion and model for him. It is safe to leave him for a little while. I have a longing to travel the deserted roads, and I have to follow it. You are a son of Melusina, I say, trying to smile. You sound like her when she had to be free to go into the water. It's like that, he agrees. Think of me as swimming away, and then the tide will bring me back. Your mind is made up, he nods. I have to have silence to hear the voice of God, he says, and silence to write my poetry, and silence to be myself. But you will come back. Within a few months, he promises. I stretch out my hands to him, and he kisses them both. You must come back, I say. I will, he says. I have given my word that only death will take me from you and yours. July, 1476. He is as good as his word, and returns from his trip to Rome in time to meet us at Fotheringay in July. Richard has planned and organized a solemn reburial of his father and his brother Edmund, who were killed in battle, made mock of, and hardly buried at all. The House of York rallies together for the funeral and the memorial service, and I am glad Anthony comes home in time to bring Prince Edward to honor his grandfather. Anthony is as brown as a moor and full of stories. We steal away together to walk in the gardens of Fotheringay. He was robbed on the road. He thought he would never get away with his life. He stayed one night beside a spring in a forest and could not sleep for the certainty that Melusina would rise out of the waters. And what would I say to her? He demands plaintively. How confusing for us all if I fell in love with my great-grandmother. He met the Holy Father. He fasted for a week and saw a vision. And now he is determined one day to set out again, but this time go farther afield. He wants to lead a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. When Edward is a man and comes to his own estate, when he is 16, I will go, he says. I smile. All right, I agree easily. That's years and years away. 10 years from now. It seems a long time now, Anthony warns me, but the years will go quickly. Is this the wisdom of the traveling pilgrim? I laugh at him. It is, he agrees. Before you know it, he'll be a young man standing taller than you, and we will have to consider what sort of a king we have made. He will be Edward V, and he will inherit a throne peacefully, please God, and continue the royal house of York without challenge. For no reason at all, I shiver. What is it? Nothing. I don't know. a shiver of cold, nothing. I know he will make a wonderful king. He's a real York, and a real son of the House of Rivers. There could be no better start for a boy. December, 1476. Christmas comes, and my darling son Prince Edward comes home to Westminster for the feast. Everyone marvels at how he has grown. He is 7 next year, and a straight-standing, handsome, fair-headed boy, with a quickness of understanding and an education that is all from Anthony, and the promise of good looks and charm that is all his father's. Anthony brings both my sons to me, Richard Grey and Prince Edward, for my blessing, and then releases them to find their brothers and sisters. I miss you all three so much, I say. And I you, he says, smiling at me. But you look well, Elizabeth. I make a face, for a woman who is sick every morning. He is delighted. You are expecting a baby again? Again. And given the sickness, they all think it will be a boy. Edward must be delighted. I assume so. He shows his delight by flirting with every woman within 100 miles. Anthony laughs. That's Edward. My brother is happy. I can tell at once from the easy set of his shoulders and the relaxed lines around his eyes. And what about you? Do you still like Ludlow? Young Edward and Richard and I have things just as we want them, he says. We are a court devoted to scholarship, chivalry, jousting and hunting. It is a perfect life for all three of us. He studies, as I report to you. He is a clever boy and a thoughtful one. And you don't let him take risks hunting. He grins at me. Of course I do. Do you want me to raise a coward for Edward's throne? He has to test his courage in the hunting field and in the jousting arena. He has to know fear and look it in the face and ride towards it. He has to be a brave king, not a fearful one. I would serve you both very ill if I steered him away from any risk and taught him to fear danger. I know, I say. It is just that he is so precious. We are all precious, Anthony declares, and we all have to live a life with risk. I am teaching him to ride any horse in the stable and to face a fight without a tremble. That will keep him safer than trying to keep him on safe horses and away from the jousting arena. Now, to far more important things. What have you got me for Christmas? And are you going to name your baby for me, if you have a boy? The court prepares for the Christmas feast with its usual extravagance, and Edward orders new clothes for all the children and ourselves as part of the pageant that the world expects from England's handsome royal family. I spend some time every day with the little Prince Edward. I love to sit beside him when he sleeps, and listen to his prayers as he goes to bed, and summon him to my rooms for breakfast every day. He is a serious little boy, thoughtful, and he offers to read to me in Latin, Greek, or French, until I have to confess that his learning far surpasses my own. He is patient with his little brother Richard, who idolizes him, following him everywhere at a determined trot, and he is tender to baby Anne, hanging over her cradle and marveling at her little hands. Every day we compose a play or a mask, every day we go hunting, every day we have a great ceremonial dinner and dancing and an entertainment. People say that the Yorks have an enchanted court, an enchanted life, and I cannot deny it. There is only one thing that casts a shadow on the days before Christmas. George, the Duke of Dissatisfaction. I do think your brother grows more peculiar every day, I complain to Edward, when he comes to my rooms in Whitehall Palace to escort me to dinner. Which one? He asks lazily. For you know I can do nothing right in the eyes of either. You would think they would be glad to have a York on the throne, and peace in Christendom, and one of the finest Christmas feasts we have ever arranged. But no, Richard is leaving court to go back north as soon as the feast is over, to demonstrate his outrage that we are not slogging away in a battle with the French. And George is simply bad-tempered. It is George's bad temper which is troubling me. Why, what has he done now? He asks. He has told his server that he will not eat anything sent to him from our table, I say. He has told him he will only eat privately, in his own room, after the rest of us have had dinner. When we send him a dish down the room to him as a gesture of courtesy for him to taste, he will refuse it. I hear he plans to send it back to us as an open insult. He will sit at the dinner table in company with an empty plate before him. He will not drink either. Edward, you will have to speak to him.
If he is refusing drink, it is more than an insult. It is a miracle.
Edward smiles. George cannot refuse a glass of wine, not if it came from the devil himself. It is no laughing matter if he uses our dinner table to insult us.
Yes, I know. I have spoken to him.
He turns to the retinue of lords and ladies who are forming a line behind us.
Give us a moment, he says, and draws me off to a window bay where he can talk without being overheard.
Actually, it's worse than you know, Elizabeth. I think he is spreading rumors against us.
Saying what? I ask.
George's resentment of his older brother was not satisfied by his failed rebellion and forgiveness. I had hoped he would settle into being one of the two greatest dukes in England. I had thought he would be happy with his wife, the way-faced Isabel and her enormous fortune, even though he lost control of his sister-in-law Anne when she married Richard. But like any mean, ambitious man, he counts his losses more than his gains. He begrudged Richard his wife, little Anne Neville. He begrudged Richard the fortune that she brought him. He cannot forgive Edward for giving Richard permission to marry her, and he watches every grant that Edward makes to my family and kinsmen, every acre of land Edward gives to Richard. You would think England was a tiny field, that he feared losing a row of peas, such is his anxious suspicion.
What can he say against us? You have been ceaselessly generous to him.
He is saying again that my mother betrayed my father and that I am a bastard, he says, his mouth to my ear.
For shame! That old story, I exclaim.
And he is claiming that he made an agreement with Warwick and Margaret of Anjou, which said that at Henry's death he should be king, so that he is rightful king now, as Henry's appointed heir.
But he killed Henry himself, I exclaim.
Hush, hush, nothing of that. I shake my head, and the veil from my headdress dances in my agitation. No, you must not be mealy-mouthed about that now, not between the two of us in private. You said at the time that his heart gave out, and that was good enough for everyone. But George cannot pretend that he is the man's chosen and named heir when he was his murderer.
He says worse, my husband warns.
Of me, I guess. He nods.
He says that you...
He breaks off and looks round to see that no one is in earshot.
He says that you are a... His voice is so low he cannot speak the word.
I shrug my shoulders.
A witch?
He nods. He is not the first to say so. I suppose he will not be the last... While you are King of England, he cannot hurt me. I don't like it being said about you, not just for your reputation, but for your safety. It is a dangerous name to attach to a woman, whoever her husband might be. And besides, everyone always goes on to say that our marriage was an enchantment, and that leads them to say that there was no true marriage at all. I give a little hiss like an angry cat. I care less about my own reputation. My mother taught me that a powerful woman will always attract slander. But those who say that I am not truly married would make bastards of my sons. This is to disinherit them.
You will have to silence him.
I have spoken to him. I have warned him. But I imagine that despite it all, he is making a cause against me. He has followers, more every day. And I think he may be in touch with Louis of France.
We have a peace treaty with King Louis.
Doesn't stop his meddling. I think nothing will ever stop his meddling,
and George is fool enough to take his money and cause me trouble. I look around. The court is waiting for us. We have to go in to dinner, I say. What are you going to do? I shall speak to him again. But in the meantime, don't send him any dishes from our table. I don't want him making a show of refusing them. I shake my head. Dishes go to favorites, I say. He is no favorite of mine. The king laughs and kisses my hand. Don't turn him into a toad either, my little witch, he says in a whisper. I don't need to. He's that in his heart already. Edward does not tell me what he says to this, his most difficult brother, and not for the first time I wish my mother was still with me. I need her advice. After a few weeks of sulking and refusing to dine with us, stalking around the palace as if he were afraid to sit down, drawing away from me as if my very gaze might turn him to stone, George announces that Isabel, in the last months of her pregnancy, is ill. Sickened by the air, he announces pointedly, and he is taking her from court. Perhaps it's for the best, my brother Anthony says to me hopefully one morning, as we walk back to my rooms after Mass. My ladies are behind me, except for Lady Margaret Stanley, who is still on her knees in chapel, bless her. She prays like a woman who has sinned against the Holy Ghost itself, but I know for a fact that she is innocent of everything. She does not even bed her husband. I think she is quite without desire. My guess is that nothing stirs that celibate Lancastrian heart but ambition. He has everyone asking what Edward has done to anger him, and he is insulting to both of you. He's got people talking about whether Prince Edward resembles his father, and how anyone can know if he is your true-born son since he was born in sanctuary without proper witnesses. I asked Edward for permission to challenge him to a joust. He cannot be allowed to speak of you as he does. I want to defend your name. What did Edward say? He said better to ignore him than give any support to his lies by challenging them. But I don't like it. And he abuses you and our family, our mother too. It's nothing to what he does to his own, I remark. He calls our mother a witch, but his own he names as a whore. He is not a man who is afraid to slander. I am surprised his mother does not order his silence. I think she has done so, and Edward has reprimanded him in private, but nothing will stop him. He is beside himself with spite. At least if he is away from court, he will not be forever whispering in corners and refusing to dance. As long as he does not plot against us. Once he is far away in his house, surrounded by his retainers, Edward will know nothing of who he is summoning, till he has men in the field again and Edward has a rebellion on his hands. Oh, Edward will know, I say shrewdly. He will have men watching George. Even I have a paid servant in his house. Edward will have dozens. I will know what he is doing before he does it. Who is your man? Anthony asks. I smile. It does not have to be a man to watch and understand and report. I have a woman in his household, and she tells me everything. My spy, Anchorette, sends me weekly reports, and she tells me that George is indeed receiving letters from France, our enemy. Then, just before Christmas Day, she writes of the failing health of his wife, Isabel. The little Duchess gives birth to another child, her fourth, but does not recover her strength, and only weeks after her confinement, she gives up the struggle to live, turns her face away from the world, and dies. I pray for her soul with genuine feeling. She was a terribly unlucky girl. Her father, Warwick, adored her and thought he would make her a duchess, and then thought he could make her husband a king. But instead of a handsome York king, her husband was a sulky younger son who turned his coat not once, but twice. After she lost her first baby in the wild seas in the witch's wind off Calais, she had two more children, Margaret and Edward. Now they will have to manage without her. Margaret is a bright, clever girl, but Edward is slow in understanding, perhaps even simple. God help both of them with George as their only parent. I sent a letter expressing my sorrow, and the court wears mourning for her, the daughter of a great earl, and the wife of a royal duke. January, 1477. We mourn for her, but George has barely buried her, barely blown out the candles, before he comes strutting back to court, full of plans for a new wife, and this time he is aiming high. Charles of Burgundy, the husband of our Margaret of York, has died in battle, and his daughter Mary is a duchess and heiress of one of the wealthiest duchies in Christendom. Margaret, always a Yorkist and fatally blind to the faults of her family, suggests that her brother George, so fortunately free, should marry her stepdaughter, thereby consulting the needs of her York brother more than her Burgundy ward, or so I think. George, of course, is at once on fire with ambition. He announces to Edward that he will take either the Duchess of Burgundy or the Princess of Scotland. Impossible, Edward says. He is faithless enough when he has a duke's income paid by me. If he were as rich as a prince with an independent fortune, none of us would be safe. Think of the trouble he would cause for us in Scotland. Dear God, think of him bullying our sister Margaret in Burgundy. She's only just widowed, her stepdaughter newly orphaned. I would as willingly send a wolf to the two of them as George. Spring, 1477. George broods over his brother's refusal. And then we hear outrageous news, news so extraordinary that we start by thinking it must be an exaggerated rumour. It cannot be true. George suddenly declares that Isabel died not of childbed fever, but of poisoning, and bundles the poisoner into jail. Never, I exclaim to Edward. Has he run mad? Who would have hurt Isabel? Who is he arrested? Why? It is worse than arrest, he says. He looks quite stunned by the letter in his hand. He must be crazed. He has rushed this woman's servant before a jury and ordered them to find her guilty of murder, and he has had her beheaded. She is dead already. Dead on George's word, as if there were no law of the land, as if he were a greater power than the law, greater than the king. He is ruling my kingdom as if I had allowed tyranny. Who is she? Who was she? I demand. The poor serving girl. Ancaret Twino, he says, reading the name from the letter of complaint. The jury says he threatened them with violence and made them bring in a verdict of guilty, though there was no evidence against her but his oath. They say they did not dare refuse him and that he forced them to send an innocent woman to her death. He accused her of poison and witchcraft, and of serving a great witch. He raises his eyes from the letter and sees my white face. A great witch? Do you know anything of this, Elizabeth? She was my spy in his household, I confess quickly, but that is all. I had no need to poison poor little Isabel. What would I gain from it? And witchcraft is nonsense. Why would I cast a spell on her? I didn't like her, nor her sister, but I wouldn't ill-wish them. He nods. I know, of course you didn't have Isabel poisoned. But did George know that the woman he accused was in your pay? Perhaps, perhaps. Why else would he accuse her? What else could she have done to offend him? Does he mean to warn me, to threaten us? Edward throws down the letter on the table. God knows. What does he hope to gain by murdering a servant woman but to cause more trouble and gossip? I shall have to act on this, Elizabeth. I can't let it go. What will you do? He has a little group of his own advisers, dangerous, dissatisfied men. One of them is certainly a practicing fortune-teller, if not worse. I shall arrest them. I shall bring them to trial. I shall do to his men what he has done to your servant. It can serve as a warning for him. He cannot challenge us or our servants without risk to himself. I only hope he has the sense to see it. I nod. They cannot hurt us, I ask, these men.
Only if you believe, as George seems to think, that they can cast a spell against us.
I smile in the hope of hiding my fear. Of course I believe that they can cast a spell against us. Of course I fear that they have already done so. I am right to be troubled. Edward arrests the notorious sorcerer Thomas Burdett and two others, and they are put to question, and a farrago of stories of black arts and threats and enchantments starts to spill out. My brother Anthony finds me leaning my heavy belly on the river wall and staring into the water at Whitehall Palace on a sunny May afternoon. Behind me, in the gardens, the children are playing a game of bat and ball. By the outraged cries of cheating, I guess that my son Edward is losing and taking advantage of his status as Prince of Wales to change the score.
What are you doing here? Anthony asks.
I am wishing this river was a moat that could keep me and mine safe from enemies without.
Does Melusina come when you call her from the waters of the Thames? He asks with a skeptical smile.
If she did, I would have her hang George, Duke of Clarence, alongside his wizard, and I would have her do that to them both at once, without more words.
You don't believe that the man could hurt you from ill-wishing, he demands.
He is no wizard. There is no such thing. It is a fairy tale to frighten children, Elizabeth.
He glances back at my children, who are appealing to Elizabeth for a ruling on a dropped catch.
George believes him. He paid him good money to foretell the king's death, and then some more to bring it about by overlooking. George hired this wizard to destroy us. Already his spells are in the air, in the earth, even in the water.
Oh, nonsense. He is no more a wizard than you are a witch.
I don't claim to be a witch, I say quietly, but I have Melusina's inheritance. I am her heir. You know what I mean. I have her gift, just as Mother did, just as my daughter Elizabeth has. The world sings to me, and I hear the song. Things come to me, my wishes come true. Dreams speak to me. I see signs and portents, and sometimes I know what will happen in the future. I have the sight.
These could all be revelations from God, he says firmly. This is the power of prayer. All the rest is wishful thinking and women's nonsense.
I smile. I think they are from God. I never doubt it. But God speaks to me through the river.
You are a heretic and a pagan, he says with brotherly scorn.
Melusina is a fairy story, but God and his son are your avowed faith. For heaven's sake, you have founded religious houses and chantries and schools in his name. Your love of rivers and streams is a superstition, learned from our mother, like that of ancient pagans. You can't puddle them up into a religion of your own, and then frighten yourself with devils of your own devising.
Of course, brother, I say with my eyes cast down. You are a nobleman of learning. I am sure you know best.
Stop! He throws up a hand, laughing.
Stop! You need not think I'm going to try to debate with you. You have your own theology, I know, part fairy tale and part Bible and all nonsense.
Please, for all of our sakes, make it a secret religion. Keep it to yourself, and don't frighten yourself with imaginary enemies.
But I do dream true.
If you say so.
Anthony! My whole life is a proof of magic that I can foresee.
Name one thing.
Did I not marry the King of England?
Did I not see you stand out on the road like the strumpet you are?
I exclaim against his crow of laughter.
It was not like that. It was not like that. And besides, my ring came to me from the river.
He takes my hands and kisses them both.
It is all nonsense, he says gently. There is no Melusina, but an old, half-forgotten story that Mother used to tell us at bedtime. There is no enchantment, but Mother encouraging you with play. You have no powers. There is nothing but what we can do as sinners under the will of God. And Thomas Burdett has no powers but ill will and a huckster's promise. I smile at him, and I don't argue. But in my heart, I know that there is more. How did the story of Melusina end? My little boy Edward asks me that night when I'm listening to his bedtime prayers. He is sharing a room with his 3-year-old brother Richard, and both boys look at me hopefully, wanting a story to delay their bedtime. Why would you ask? I sit on a chair beside their fire and draw a footstool towards me so I can put up my feet to rest. I can feel the new baby stir in my body. I am 6 months into my time, and what feels like a lifetime yet to go. I heard my Lord Uncle Anthony speak to you of her today, Edward says. What happened after she came out of the water and married the knight? It ends sadly, I say. I gesture to them that they must get into bed, and they obey me, but 2 pairs of unblinking, bright eyes watch me over their covers. The stories differ. Some people say that a curious traveller came to their house and spied on her and saw her becoming a fish in her bath. Some say her husband broke his word that she was free to swim alone and spied on her and saw her become fish again. But why would he mind? Edward asks sensibly, since she was half fish when he met her. Ah, he thought he could change her to be the woman he wanted, I say. Sometimes a man likes a woman, but then hopes he can change her. Perhaps he was like that. Is there any fighting in this story? Richard asks sleepily, as his head droops to the pillow. No, none, I say. I kiss Edward's forehead, and then I go to the other bed and kiss Richard. They both still smell like babies, of soap and warm skin. Their hair is soft and smells of fresh air. So what happens when he knows she is half fish? Edward whispers as I go to the door. She takes the children and leaves him, I say, and they never meet again. I blow out a branch of candles but leave the other burning. The firelight in the little grate makes the room warm and cozy. That's really sad, Edward says mournfully. Poor man, that he could not see his children or his wife again. It is sad, I say, but it is just a story. Perhaps there is another ending that people forgot to tell. Perhaps she forgave him and went back to him. Perhaps he turned into a fish for love and swam after her. Yes. A happy boy, he is easily comforted. Good night, Mama. Good night, and God bless you both. When he saw her, the water lapping on her scales, head down in the bath he had built especially for her, thinking that she would like to wash, not to revert to fish, he had that instant revulsion that some men feel when they understand, perhaps for the first time, that a woman is truly other. She is not a boy, though she is weak like a boy, nor a fool, though he has seen her tremble with feeling like a fool. She is not a villain in her capacity to hold a grudge, nor a saint in her flashes of generosity. She is not any of these male qualities. She is a woman, a thing quite different to a man. What he saw was a half-fish, but what frightened him to his soul was the being which was a woman. George's malice to his brother becomes horribly apparent in the days of the trial of Burdett and his conspirators. When they hunt for evidence, the plot unravels to reveal a tangle of dark promises and threats, recipes for poisoned capes, a sachet of ground glass and outright curses. In Burdett's papers, they find not only a chart of days drawn up to foretell Edward's death, but a set of spells designed to kill him. When Edward shows them to me, I cannot stop myself shivering. I tremble as if I had an ague. Whether they can cause death or not, I know that these ancient drawings on dark paper have a malevolent power. They make me cold, I say. They feel so cold and damp. They feel evil. Certainly they are evil evidence, Edward says grimly. I would not have dreamed that George could have gone so far against me. I would have given the world for him to live at peace with us, or at the very least to keep this quiet. But he hired such incompetent men that now everyone knows that my own brother was conspiring against me. Burdett will be found guilty, and he will hang for his crime. But it is bound to come out that George directly commissioned him. George is guilty of treason too, but I cannot put my own brother on trial. Why not? I ask sharply. I am seated on a low cushioned stool by the fire in my bedroom, wearing only my fur-lined nightcape. We are on our way to our separate beds, but Edward cannot keep his trouble to himself any longer. Burdett's slimy spells may not have hurt his health, but they have darkened his spirit. Why can you not put George on trial and send him to a traitor's death? He deserves it. Because I love him, he says simply. As much as you do your brother, Anthony, I cannot send him to the scaffold. He is my little brother. He has been at my side in battle. He is my kinsman. He is my mother's favorite. He is our George. He has been on the other side in battle, too, I remind him. He has been a traitor to you and your family more than once already. He would have seen you dead if he and Warwick had caught you and you had not escaped. He named me as a witch. He had my mother arrested. He stood by and watched as they killed my father and my brother John. He lets neither justice nor family feeling block his way. Why should you? Edward, seated in the chair on the other side of the fire, leans forward. His face in the flickering light looks old. For the first time I see the weight of years and kingship on him. I know. I should be harder on him, but I cannot. He is my mother's pet. He is our little golden boy. I cannot believe he is so vicious. I give him the word. Your little pet has become vicious. He is a grown dog now, not a sweet puppy. And he has a bad nature that has been spoiled from birth. You will have to deal with him, Edward, mark my words. When you treat him with kindness, he repays you with plots. Perhaps, he says, and sighs. Perhaps he will learn. He will not learn, I promise. You will only be safe from him when he is dead. You will have to do it, Edward. You can only choose the when and the where. He gets up and stretches and goes to the bed. Let me see you into your bed before I go to my own rooms. I shall be glad when the baby is born and we can sleep together again. In a minute, I reply. I lean forward and look into the embers. I am the heiress to a water goddess. I never see well in flames. But in the gleam of the ashes I can make out George's petulant face and something behind him, a tall building. Dark as a finger post. The tower. It is always a dark building for me, a place of death. I shrug my shoulders. Perhaps it means nothing. I rise up and go to bed and huddle under the covers, and Edward takes my hands to kiss me good night. Why, you're chilled, he says in surprise. I thought the fire was warm enough. I hate that place, I say at random. What place? The Tower of London. I hate it. George's familiar, the traitor Burdett, protests his innocence on the scaffold at Tyburn, before a catcalling crowd, and is hanged anyway. But George, learning nothing from the death of his man, rides in a fury from London and marches into the King's Council meeting at Windsor Castle and repeats the speech, shouting it in Edward's face. Never, I say to Anthony. I am quite scandalized. He did. Anthony is choking with laughter, trying to describe the scene to me, In my rooms at the castle, my lady seated in my presence chamber, Anthony and I tucked away in my private rooms for him to tell me the scandalous news. There is Edward.